From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. For today's Martin Luther King holiday, we're going to listen back to some of the best interviews from Radio Times past. We'll hear from Michael Eric Dyson, Georgetown University professor, about his book Tears We Cannot Stop. It's about the nature of race relations that have long caused the African-American community grief, rage, and frustration. We'll also honor the legacy of Dr. King with King scholar Jonathan Ryder. We'll talk about Dr. King's letter from Birmingham Jail, which some argue is a more accurate description of King's politics than his more famous I Have a Dream speech. But first, we'll listen to America's Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith about how she became interested in poetry, and she'll read from some of her work. That's all coming up when Radio Times continues after the news. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us on this Martin Luther King Day. We're going to begin the show today with Tracy K. Smith. She's a professor of creative writing at Princeton University and is our poet laureate. She's published three collections of poetry with her fourth, Wade in the Water, to be published later this year. She joins us to talk about her work, the creative process, and her life, which she wrote about in her memoir, Ordinary Light. Let's listen. What's interesting, and I guess poets labor under this, which is helping the rest of us not feel so either afraid of poetry or misunderstanding poetry or somehow feeling as if poetry is over there and it's not part of our lives.
Yeah.
Do you understand that?
Well, it's funny. I have young kids and I see every day how they are quite naturally poets. They live in metaphor. They have a sense of wonder and transformation and association that is what poems are built of. And then I think that throughout life, we get pulled away from that mindset. We get told that logic and order are the governing principles. And then sometimes we get told that poems have an ulterior motive that we've got to try and...
We don't trust them?
Yeah, we're made to think the poem is saying one thing, but it's really saying something else. And I think that's probably a misguided way of saying there's lots that's active in any given poem. And the surface of language and the surface of content is a real feature of a poem. And that's something that you can lean on. And you can also trust that it might guide you to think about other related or even sort of tangential topics differently.
I read that there was this famous Emily Dickinson poem, I'm Nobody, Who Are You?, that just grabbed you.
Yeah.
How come? And I have it right here. It's very simple.
I felt... should I read the poem?
Yeah, I was going to say, let me pass this across the table there. Go ahead.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog.
So simple, and yet...
It's so simple and joyful. The sounds of language and the images, I can, you know, recall thinking, oh, how interesting to think of a frog as something public. But what spoke to me most powerfully was that first line of the poem or that first stanza where someone is saying, I recognize something in you that is true for me. And feeling drawn into what I always think of as a sense of collusion, being made to recognize something that felt true about myself that I'd never thought of before. And I think that's what good poems do all the time.
You felt like a nobody. I mean, I think a lot of us have gone through periods of our life where you felt like a nobody.
And then this poem kind of turns that into something that's beautiful. Like, how wonderful to be able to protect this inner strangeness, this private space, and have it for yourself at least some of the time. The truths that poems alert us to are changing. You know, like you return to a poem 30 years later and you find something different within it. But that's something that really excites me. There's a momentary truth that a poem can give you access to, and that can be enough.
You wrote a poem, as I understand it, in response to that poem called Humor. Is that true? And do you remember a line or two?
I remember the very pompous closing lines of the poem. So I thought that Dickinson's speaker was wise. That's what I really wanted to embody. And I wrote a poem that was thinking in very serious terms about the value of humor, and it ended, "Treat me well, for I shall," or "Treat me with care, for I shall do you well in years to come." You know, not very poetic
for fifth
lines,
grader. Not bad.
There was a wish in there somewhere.
Well, I'd love to have you read one of your newer poems, and this is from your forthcoming book of poetry called Wade in the Water.
Yeah. This is a poem that emerged out of visiting a Ring Shout performance in Georgia. And I entered into the space, and one of the performers, who I now know is a really beautiful woman named Bertha McKnight, she's a member of the Geechee Gullah Ring Shouters, greeted me, and she said, "I love you."
I'd been just like that.
Yeah. I'd been, you know, visiting a lot of historic sites, places that were commemorating the tragic, you know, institution of slavery in one way or another, and the people who came out of that and the culture that came out of that. And so there was a part of me that was hurting on this trip. And then to be greeted by someone who is a steward in some ways of a culture that emerged from that institution, and to be greeted with such love was healing. Wade in the Water. One of the women greeted me. "I love you," she said. She didn't know me, but I believed her, and a terrible new ache rolled over in my chest, like in a room where the drapes have been swept back. "I love you. I love you," as she continued down the hall, past other strangers, each feeling pierced suddenly by pillars of heavy light. "I love you" throughout the performance, in every hand clap, every stomp. "I love you" in the rusted iron chains someone was made to drag until love let them be unclasped and left empty in the center of the ring. "I love you" in the water where they pretended to wade, singing that old blood-deep song that dragged us to those banks and cast us in. "I love you," the angles of it scraping at each throat, shouldering past the swirling dust motes in those beams of light that whatever we now knew we could let ourselves feel new to climb. Oh, woods. Oh, dogs. Oh, tree. Oh, gun. Oh, girl, run. Oh, miraculous many gone. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. Is this love the trouble you promised?
Wow. Thank you so much for reading that, Tracy K. Smith, reading, I guess, the title poem from your forthcoming book, Wade in the Water. There's such a shift here from this woman welcoming you and telling you she loves you, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're being chased in the woods.
Yeah.
For fear of our lives.
Yeah. It was a really powerful performance. I don't even feel like that's quite the right word. We were invited into a space where it felt like something sacred was happening, and it had to do with history, and it had to do with a sense of resilience and what I really can only describe as love or compassion that, you know, these people embodied. And when I came away from that, and I couldn't stop thinking about that moment, and it actually provided me with a different vocabulary for the kinds of questions that I had been working on in the poems that I've been working on these past years, poems that are invested in history, poems that are thinking about justice,
right?
Poems that are thinking about, you know, our private lives and the way that we relate to each other. I realized that this sense of compassion is a gift that we all have access to. We can be giving this to each other all the time, and yet it's terrifying for whatever reason to do that.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful to that, to Ms. McKnight for just framing it so simply.
Are you a religious person? Do you think of yourself as a religious person today?
I think I'm becoming more religious.
More religious.
You know, and I never used to even feel comfortable using that word. But I feel that I believe in something large. And part of writing Life on Mars was about trying to enlarge the sense of that other thing from what it was given to me, how it was given to me in the, you know, Sunday school of God with a long white beard saying, don't do this, don't do that. I wanted something that was on the same scale as this vast universe. Mm-hmm. And so the poems are struggling toward that kind of hybrid view.
So interesting, your book, Life on Mars, is in many ways constructed around your father. And your memoir is really so much about your mother.
Yeah.
And being her daughter.
I think that losing my father put me back in touch with that early loss and helped me to process it in a way that I hadn't been able to when I was 22.
You were 22 when your mom died.
Yeah. And my father died 14 years later. And I knew him as an adult. I knew myself better. And I was able to think about letting go of him in a way that felt more complete.
Right.
I don't think you can ever really complete that process. But I hadn't gone through that with my mother's death. And so writing the book helped me to do
yeah.
that.
I was talking to you about this before going on the air, but I have been with loved ones as they have died and taken mm-hmm. their last breath, which you write about in this memoir. And there is that moment when someone is alive and then they are dead.
Yeah.
And it is that last breath that
yeah.
just escapes through their mouth or their nose or their body, and then somehow they're gone.
Yeah, they're carried somewhere. It really feels like a departure rather than a disappearance in a way. Maybe that's just something I've been kind of trained to mm-hmm. to recognize. But I felt a similar sense of proximity to that other realm when my children were born. You know, this sense that there's this largeness we belong to that we will return to.
The people come and go, right?
Yeah. This is a poem that's kind of struggling with that sense of the mystery, kind of wishing it closer. The angels. Two slung themselves across chairs once in a motel room, grizzled in leather biker gear, emissaries for something I needed to see. I was worn down by an awful panic, a wrenching in the gut, contortions. They sat there at the table while I slept. I could sense them with a deck of playing cards between them. To think of how they smelled, what comes to mind is rum and gasoline. And when they spoke, though I couldn't, I dared not look, I glimpsed how one's teeth were ground down almost to nubs, which makes me hope some might be straight-up thugs, young, slim, raw, who bounce and roll with fearsome grace, whose very voices cause faint souls to quake. Quake then, fools, and fall away. What God do you imagine we obey? Think of the toil we must cost them, one scaled perfectly to eternity. And still they come, telling us through the ages not to fear. Just those two, that once and never again for me since, though there are there sightings, flashes, hints, a proud tree in vivid sun, branches swaying in strong wind, rain hurling itself at the roof, boulders, mounds of earth mistaken for dead does, lions in crouch. A rust-stained pipe where a house once stood, which I take each time I pass it for an owl. Bright whirl, so dangerous and near. My mother sat whispering with it at the end of her life, while all the rooms of our house filled up with night.
That was my conversation with poet laureate and Princeton professor of creative writing Tracy K. Smith, recorded last summer. Her upcoming collection of poetry, Wade in the Water, will be available this April. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my discussion about Dr. Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail when we talk with King scholar Jonathan Ryder. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this very short break. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We continue our Martin Luther King Day special by revisiting Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail, considered one of the most important documents of the civil rights era. It was written by King after breaking anti-demonstration laws, part of the Birmingham campaign against racial segregation. King scholar Jonathan Ryder wrote about the importance of this letter in his book Gospel of Freedom, and he joins us to discuss the background of the letter and the role it played in the larger civil rights movement of the 1960s. Let's listen. I want to pick up on something that he writes in the letter and that his frustration with moderates, whether it was the Kennedy administration or these moderate white clergy in Alabama. And King writes, first, I must confess, over the past few years, I've been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I've almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice.
You know, this summarizes the core, in many ways, of the radicalism of King's critique. And even though it's put in secular terms, what happens when he confesses his disappointment midway through the letter, he really stops trying to persuade whites of the rightness of the cause, and he switches to chastising them. And King is always refined and mannerly, so he says, I have become disappointed. But what we really know from those explosions is he's furious at them, but he's expressed it as disappointment. And what he's saying there is, yes, the Klan is vicious and brutal, but they could not exist without the acquiescence and indifference of the mass of decent Americans who consider themselves, who would have condemned the primitivism of the Klan and their violence and didn't even think of themselves as racism. And so, in fact, the radicalism and the force and bite of his critique comes out there because he gives like a little portrait of their character. Well, who is – he's really saying the average American. And listen to that indictment. They always say wait. He's picking up a theme from earlier. But they really mean never. Well, that sounds like Malcolm X, you know, criticizing white technology and hypocrisy. He says they always say wait for a more convenient season. They prefer order, which is the negative piece, to the positive piece of the presence of justice. And he says they are guilty of appalling silence. And there's a moment there for the first time where you hear the voice of the prophet, the black preacher, just sneaking in there. And he says, we will have to repent for the appalling silence of the good people. That powerful moment. And what he's saying there is, don't think you are absolved of being chastised. You are acting sinfully and immorally when you don't speak up. Not acting is itself a sin. And that is just goes to the heart. And who's he talking about there? Well, he's been criticized by the Washington Post and the New York Times for not waiting, who think a new segregationist moderate is the way to go, and it's a new day in Birmingham. Everybody, including the Kennedys, are calling to say, don't do this, don't proceed. So he has a really wide range of targets there, and it's the core of American culture who's come into his sights.
He writes in the couple paragraphs before that, we know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given up by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. And this is a man who used nonviolence, demonstration sit-ins to challenge the segregationist laws.
Well, you've alighted on what may be the most important moment in the letter for laying bare King's actual philosophy of change and also revising our view of them. He wasn't just a loving dreamer. He was a tough Christian warrior. And he has no illusions there about moral language by itself to affect white hearts and minds. What he's saying there, and he's really referring to the majority of whites, few members of the oppressor class will volunteer, can understand the groans and yearnings of the oppressed race. He says you cannot have negotiations without protest and pressure because people will always look for ways to avoid it. And so you need, in a sense, this pressure and this toughness to shake people out of their moral lethargy. And again, he is a tough warrior there with no illusions that most whites on their own are going to come to a moral awakening.
Well, and then he goes on to say, and this is a list of the kind of, day-to-day humiliations that African-Americans had to experience. And I'm going to quote here, and I'm quoting from Martin Luther King, when you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored, when your first name becomes nigger, your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title Mrs., when you are harried by day and night by the fact that you are a Negro living constantly in tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments. That's just a couple of lines pulled out of this long list of slights and humiliations.
In my mind, that's the most dramatic moment in all of the letter, because what has happened there? The man we identify as a symbol of beloved community and universal love and all God's children has now shifted out of that role into the role of every Negro. He's talking as a black man. At first he said, I'm here because injustice is here. Now he's speaking as a black man, laying bare all of the vulnerability and humiliation of being a black man. And there are a couple ways to think of this passage. One is that in many ways it's a retreat from beloved community. He's given up on trying to say we're all the same. So I'm telling you like it is as a black man, but I think you can see it as a gracious and generous move in two different ways. One, he's allowing the masses of white people to have an intimate glimpse on what of black vulnerability.
Because he personalizes it.
He's
right?
Personalizing it. And when he says, when you have to explain to a six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the segregated fun town, well, that's Yolanda King. That's King's little girl. And when King performed that little vignette before black audiences in black churches, he would say, that tremulous, I look down into the eyes of that little girl. And he has perfectly captured Yolanda. Daddy, I've been seeing Fun Town on TV, and I want to go to Fun Town. And so it's an intimate glimpse, allowing whites to see. In a way, it's a crossover moment. He's taken them into on a tour of black life, but it's gracious in another sense. He's saying maybe whites are clueless, but they may not be hopeless. Maybe I can't convince them with rational reasons and moral appeal, but pathos. Maybe I can make them feel as a human being and a parent what it means to suffer from racism in America.
You have been quoted as saying that Martin Luther King was a badass. And perhaps this letter underscores that?
Well, King's badass, it's veiled and oblique in the letter. As it, just like the anger is always put a little bit indirect, but there are glimpses of it. But if you listen to King, and that's one of the things I've tried to do in Gospel of Freedom, because I've benefited from some rare recordings of King in the mass meetings. So in a way, you can see him before black audiences saying some of the same words. So in the letter, when he talks about, that these two segregationist mayors, one is articulate and nice, but the other, is nasty, but they're the same. But when he does that in a black mass meeting, he's theatrical and sarcastic. And he says, now, it may be true that Mr. Boutwell is a more refined and gentle and nice person. He says, and King has almost a jaunty lilt, I am a segregationist. Mm. And Bull Connor may be less articulate and goes, I'm a segregationist. But they're both the same thing. And that kind of aspect of King that's not afraid to be a little more down home and sarcastic. And that's not his general mode, but black people in the mass meetings always erupt when King is being funny and the badass appears, because it's just a little accent that they know they're hints of. And that creeps into letter, because what's he doing? He's telling whites to their face how angry he is at them.
I think what's so powerful about this letter is how personal it is, obviously, as we were just talking. But also he's quoting from philosophers. He talks about just and unjust laws. I mean, it seems like he is pouring his whole sort of heart and soul out into this letter, expressing his frustration and obvious anger.
Well, he's pouring his heart and soul and mind in theology. And I think you've hit on what to me is one of its striking features. I think of this as a kind of two-act play with different scenes. So it's like a roller coaster, emotionally and also in narratively. So suddenly, you know, we have the learned professor. And then we have the cocky black man who's schooling these theologians in the tenets of their own faith, citing Martin Buber and Paul Tillich. And then we have the angry prophet chastising. So it's like jump cuts from one mode to another. And there's another thing that's often left out about this. I don't know if you want to get into it now, but the sense of black self-sufficiency that is a central theme, especially at the end of this letter, because there is a part of him that is declaring, you know, we welcome white allies. We hope you can join us. We want the white church. And King never stopped reaching out to whites, but he's prepared to go it alone, and he's prepared to accept that blacks are pretty much alone in an indifferent nation. And it reverses everything we think about the American dream and American exceptionalism.
And also his, I mean, did he maintain his belief in integration? I mean, was he beginning to doubt the possibility of integration?
He never doubted that. You know, that was too much embedded in his primal Christian faith. And what did he like to say? It's the Apostle Paul's line. In Christ, there is no east nor west, no free nor bond, nor black nor white. That's him adding it. So for him, the divisions among mankind are an affront to his basic vision of Christianity, and that's the foundation of King. And he may have put on, you know, more theologically refined versions of this, but at heart, it's his passionate faith in Jesus that is his guidance. However, at the same time, he has an amazing sense of black solidarity. Hmm. And so when he's in, you know, again, it's the same thing. When he's in Selma, he doesn't say, I am here because injustice is here. He also says, I am here because my people are suffering. I come by here to help you sing. Come by here, Lordy, Lord. And if you look at the end of this letter, what does he say? He says, I have no fear, despite our setbacks, that we will win in Birmingham. But he doesn't say what we know he really believes, which is my faith in God, which is after the crucifixion is the resurrection. There is a bomb in Gilead. My God is able. All of those things that he says, he refuses to say to white clergymen. And I think it's because he has disdain for them because they are guilty of blasphemy. What he says, and this is years before the Black Pride movement has really flourished, he says, abused and scorned though we may be, we were here before the Pilgrims, before Thomas Jefferson sketched the mighty words of the Declaration. And notice what he's doing. He is putting that defiant insistence that blacks belong before all the civic heroes like Thomas Jefferson. And the other thing he immediately says is, for 200 years, our forebears, our slave ancestors, built this country in the homes of the mansions of the slave owners. If the inexcusable cruelties of slavery could not stop us, the current setbacks will not stop us. His faith is in his ancestors, their spirituality, in the sustenance he takes from black people, not the American dream, not Thomas Jefferson, not the notion that America is destined to be a democracy.
So King is held for, what, 8 days in this Birmingham jail? He writes this letter that has lived on well into its 50th year. What happened to this letter? Was it sent to the eight clergymen? I know the American Friends Service Committee here in Philadelphia, they published the letter later. But what happened once he was released?
Well, the American Friends Service Committee here in Philadelphia has a glorious history because they have been supporting King since, you know, Montgomery boycott. They had helped arrange his visit to India. But, but that's later in May. So King gets out of jail on April 20th and nothing's going on. Nobody, you know, they distribute the letter in the next, you know, in those weeks to come. Journalists do not suddenly think this is the great, amazing document of American culture. nothing has happened to the movement while King was in jail. Nobody's going to jail. People are afraid of the injunction. So he's back where he was before he went into jail. And there's a fear that it's still going to fail. And this is the important thing. The difference is King's warrior spirit has been reborn in the act of writing that letter. But meanwhile, who's going to embody the letter's vision of being an extremist for love and justice? King had a cautious streak. And he's hesitating to use the children and young people because he knows they'll be criticized. But no adults. They've run out of adults to go to jail. And while King is away in Shuttlesworth, meanwhile, his younger colleagues and more incautious colleagues have been organizing the young of Birmingham, simply set D-Day for May 2nd, which is 2 weeks after he gets out of jail. And King comes back on May 1st and discovered there's been a coup, and D-Day is set for the very next day. And he still doesn't endorse it. He's marveling at this church full of people. But the next day, when those 1,000 young black, some as young as 9 years old, 14, 18-year-olds, burst out the front door of 16th Street Baptist Church and go up against Bull Connor, King is lifted because he sees the letter's philosophy and vision executed by these impish, antic young people who don't look like the early Christians. They look like young teenagers who are somewhat of a badass themselves.
Well, and what we also saw, those of us that were alive then and could see on TV, you could see Bull Connor and others, the police, the safety commissioner, putting the hoses and the dogs on these demonstrators, which seemed like a pretty important turning point.
Okay, the first day, Bull Connor doesn't lose it. He keeps his control. But it's Double D Day the following day, May 3rd. And it's a turning point for American culture. That is the day the foundation of American race relations cracks. And Bull Connor really couldn't hold it together. And they use the dogs and the water hoses. And it's that picture in the New York Times the following day. President Kennedy sees that and he's aghast and he realizes he is going to have to do something. And that begins the momentum towards what will be a Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it gives a kind of empirical confirmation, if I may use a bit of jargon, to King's theory in the letter that people never do the moral thing absent pressure and the spectacle of protest. And here you have a case. Kennedy and the moderates were not prepared to move until that happened. But you hear King just immediately after the hoses, and he's subdued. His voice is like not his usual calm preacher voice. And he says, "Today was a mean day in Birmingham. They were mean to us."
That was my 2013 interview with Jonathan Ryder, a Martin Luther King scholar, about his book Gospel of Freedom, which examines Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my discussion with Michael Eric Dyson about his book Tears We Cannot Stop. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Michael Eric Dyson is an ordained minister, a public intellectual, and an author. When Alton Sterling and Philando Castile were killed by police officers, he felt compelled to write an op-ed for the New York Times called Death in Black and White. The piece garnered a lot of attention, which inspired Dyson to write the book Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. The book outlines the litany of reasons that African Americans are feeling grief, rage, and frustration about the state of race relations. He joins us to discuss the book and his feelings about the Obama administration. Let's take a listen. This is a sermon. And I think for secular people, a sermon means a one-way conversation.
Right.
You're telling us something, and we're not allowed to respond. What do you mean by sermon?
Yeah, no, not at all. I'm glad you clarified that, because that is one version of the sermon. Another one is, and that's somebody speaking from the pulpit, you know, absolutely thundering down truths. But mine is more in the trenches with the people, bearing witness to and testifying for, on behalf of, and even along with the people whose hearts are broken, who bear the grief and the suffering. And I'm trying to offer some kind of consolation in the midst of the woundedness. And so, as Henri Nouwen talked about the wounded healer, that's the kind of thing I have in mind. So, no, this is a two-way conversation between me and people that I've talked to for years and years, white brothers and sisters. And really, it's me putting that conversation in the form of a sermon to really try to remind us of our best virtues and our best understanding of America and democracy.
You even write that God called you to write this book, to give this sermon.
Yeah, I rarely use that kind of language. But, you know, because I was, you know, metaphorically ripping up pages deleting words from the screen, writing 50, 60 pages. Nah, that's not really it. And I was, you know, frustrated. The editor is frustrated. Is this what we gave you a contract for? And I mean, she didn't say it that way, but I knew that's what it was. And I'm struggling and so on. And then I laid down one night and it hit me, the inspiration, man, you just got to preach. That's what you do. You know, as the old black folks say, I had my burning before I had my learning. So I went back to my roots and out it sprang.
You use the word beloved when referring to or speaking to white people.
Right.
And again, you know, sermon, beloved, these
are all
loaded words. I was thinking with that phrase, with all due respect, which sometimes means the opposite of that.
Course.
What do you mean when you say beloved?
I just simply want to show that there's affection involved, that there is a love that connects me to you, the listener, the hearer. Beloved in Song of Solomon, my precious gifted one. And it also, beloved, you know, if you go to any black church, go to, say, here, Calvin Butts at Abyssinian Baptist Church, where Adam Clayton Powell held forth, and he uses the word beloved. That's a common phrase, especially among black ministers of a certain ilk and generation, to speak to those who are in their congregation. And that's my affectionate term for white brothers and sisters, because some of that love is tough, and I wanted them to feel the love, too.
I began where you began, which was being pulled over by the cops. You also talk about your son, other incidents that you've had with police. Is that, in terms of white people understanding what it means to be a black person, is that the incident that white people need to understand better?
I think so. I think because there's so much involved there. There's the disbelief that, oh, it can't be the way you say it is. That's not true. I get stopped by the police all the time. It's not that way. It's questioning whether or not the information being relayed is really honest and really above board. You know, this is why even President Obama, who was not known for a fuselage of racial discourse, said, you know, people are not just making this up. He really had to keep telling America because he knew people just didn't believe it. And now when the video starts surfacing, now, even though there's quibbling, I mean, people are, you know, film critics now, mise-en-scene, and this is what happened before and after, and this is the denouement. Well, the reality is that now there's literal photographic proof, visual proof that there are consternations and really conflicts that occur between the police and black people. And it's frustrating because we're not believed. And I think many white Americans don't understand the feeling of terror. And I use that deliberately. We feel, many black people, terrorized by the police because at any moment, any arbitrary encounter with the police can end in death or violence, and it is truly terrorizing.
You wrote something in the New Republic. You say every encounter with the police splits us into two selves, one the quiet, brooding figure cursing the cops from within, the other a dawdling doppelganger, a concrete, staring, shuffling Negro we are ashamed to admit lives inside us.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
I thought that was pretty powerful.
Thank you. I mean, and I felt that so many times. You know, I got a PhD from Princeton. You know, I'm well recognized at what I do. I've gotten a bit of fame for it and celebrity and recognition from my peers. And yet I feel so humiliated, so dehumanized. And at any moment, somebody in recognition of those talents might be even more hostile and willing to pull a gun, to pull a trigger, to direct violence toward me and many others who don't even have that buffer to keep them alive. So, yeah, it's a real split self. It's a schizophrenia. In charge, commanding, self-assured on the one hand, and on the other hand, in an unprincipled fashion, deferential to the person before me.
You said, sort of broadly speaking, that African-Americans fear the cops. Do they also fear African-American cops? Is that a different interchange, interaction?
Right. That's a great question. And in some instances, yes, there is the same fear. You know, I think of that lyric from N.W.A., and don't let it be a black and a white one, because they'll throw you down to the street top, black police showing out for the white cop. So there is a degree to which the code of blue is the most important color, even among some cops. But more broadly speaking, they just did a recent study, and black police and white police live in two different universes. And I've spoken for police associations. I spoke for the Dallas Black Police Association about 6 months, 7 months before that horrible incident.
Yes.
And I'll tell you, many of the black cops came up to me and said, you nailed it, because I challenged the white cops in the room to say, there's a different universe. If you can roll up on somebody and not think they're a criminal and treat them like your mother or your sister or your cousin or your uncle or your father, the outcome is different. Yes, protect yourself, but also see that this person is not attempting to kill you automatically by breathing. And the black cops usually don't are not the ones who end up killing, hurting, maiming, or otherwise harming black and Latino people. There's a huge racial disconnect there.
What do you want white people to do?
Well, I want them to think in a way that allows them to be vulnerable, to be introspective, to understand what white privilege is. It's not just some nuanced term that has been bandied about recently, or should I say new term. It's got nuance. It has more depth to it. And I want white brothers and sisters to see that whiteness is a race, too. You know, when men hear gender, we think, oh, women. No, you have a gender, too, sir. and it can often be toxic when you're not conscious of it. And when you're not conscious of it, you use it in ways that are especially destructive. So if white brothers and sisters come to grips with the fact, oh, whiteness is a race, too. They're all artificial. Yes, they're all constructed. Absolutely. Black, red, yellow, brown. We're not white. We're not born with those identities. The society in which we live gives us a sense of that. And if white brothers and sisters could come to grips with that and how privileged they have been in many ways and exempt from some of the same temptations and trials and tribulations as people of color, it would just go a long way to bettering race relations.
Well, let me get a little personal here.
Sure.
Because I feel like I have had many of the advantages of white privilege. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a middle-class family. I'm well-educated. I had health care.
Right.
I've been able to travel the world. I've gotten all the benefits, I think, of both race, but also of class as well.
Right.
And I remember working in Appalachia, this was many years ago, between high school and college, and seeing what rural white poverty looked like. Now, I'm not sure how different it is some 40 years, almost 50 years later, but it was shocking. And I think for those people, there was no privilege in being a white person living in Cold Branch Heights, West Virginia, where I was.
There's no doubt, but you must remember W.E.B. Du Bois said that many white people derive the psychic wages of whiteness. No money in the bank, but the psychological advantage of knowing that you're part of a race that's superior. Oh, you're not doing well now. That doesn't mean you as a person are a failure. That your race is great. That means you caught an unlucky break. You didn't fail because your culture is pathological. You didn't fail because you are essentially dehumanized. You failed because you didn't catch the right break. But you don't doubt in your heart and bone that you belong to a country that is built upon your people's greatness. And in that sense, Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail once. And in that sense, this can be revealed by that story. He's in jail. He's in Birmingham. The jailer's coming to him, the warden. You know, you're wrong. What you're doing is horrible. He says, no, I'm on the right side of history. He says, how much money do you make? What's your life like? And when they told him, he said, well, you need to be marching with us because you're just as, you know, poor off. You're just as poor and as bad off as Negroes are. But many white people don't understand that. So, for instance, you could be a poor white person or working class white person voting for a president who doesn't have your interests at heart because you derive a compensatory racial benefit. And how is that important? You could be a poor white person with no money in the bank, and if you encounter a policeman, if you visit New York City or somewhere else and you live, that's the greatest white privilege of all, the ability to breathe after an encounter with a representative of the state who has legitimacy ultimately to snuff you out. That's an incredible benefit. But I agree with you in terms of the similarities between working class white people and black people and poor ones, but again, we're not honest about it, many of those same people are racist themselves and racist against other black and brown people when they've got much more in common with those folk. And if they didn't have the barrier of racial hostility, they would see we could join together to form a movement that's far more powerful than the so-called blue collar billionaires who rule us.
Sort of reading it maybe between the lines of some of what right. you write in this book, you seem to also criticize, quote unquote, urban whites for looking down on rural whites. The whole sort of white trash notion.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you could read Nancy Eisenberg's book, a brilliant book on white trash.
She was on the show, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, of course, you're Marty.
I'm not trying to brag here, just trying to be helpful.
You know, so if it's real, it ain't bragging. But the reality is absolutely that condescension, that dissing of them. And I didn't just start that. I grew up in a household. My father was from Albany, Georgia. My mama from Alabama. We listen to country music. Country music is the black blues and country music and the blues are the white country music. They share a culture, an agriculture, an outlook, and it split off racially what the blues and country did, but they're joined together. They're tethered there. And I have a deep appreciation. Hank Williams is one of the great poets of American society. He could have gotten a Nobel Prize along with Bob Dylan, who's a genius, no doubt. But Hank, a great, great poet.
Do you think President Obama did enough for black people?
No. And I hesitate even to criticize Obama in light of the onslaught of, unenlightenment that we endure now. He was an extraordinary president. I think among literary presidents, people who could write and think, I'd say Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, Barack Obama. I mean, Bill Clinton. I mean, that's the pantheon that he occupies. And against all odds, he was able to do incredible work with no help at all. Having said that, I think that he was loath to speak about race. He practiced a variety of racial procrastination, a species of withholding his full energy because he didn't want to be ghettoized as the black president. I get that. But there's a difference between being ghettoized as a black president and speaking with speaking with intelligence that he possesses and great care about the issue of race and leading, but not leading from behind as he was accused of doing in foreign policy. He certainly was doing that in race. The crisis happened and then he responded.
Yeah.
The scene exploded and then he tried to put it out or at least contain it. And I think that was a faux pas. And ultimately, his huge intelligence on race was, I think, squandered. And he went out of his way to really cast aspersions against and castigate black people in a way that reinforced white people's perceptions that even the president says, you people are messed up, in a way he didn't do to white America. And my point is, I knew he couldn't do it to white America for obvious reasons. I don't have to deconstruct that for your audience. But if you can't do it to white folk, don't do it to black folk. Because if you do it to black folk, it looks like you think they're worse than the people that you refuse to talk about. And I think he inadvertently reinforced some of the very stereotypes that his own presence undercut.
You write that a lot, maybe most black people were worried in those 8 years that at some point he would be shot. And I have to say, I think a lot of white people worried about that as well. And the fact that he survived without being shot.
Right.
Is that significant?
Is
that a milestone?
It is, unfortunately and incredibly. But yes, it is. The fact that he got out alive. We held our collective breaths. And or our collective breath and said, my God, this man at any moment might be killed. Anytime somebody jumped over the White House, fence or, Secret Service was found sleeping, so to speak, at the wheel. So, yeah, there was a great deal of consternation. And as a result of that, he was graded on a curve. Mm-hmm. So the point is not that he didn't have huge achievements, which he did. But the point is that we said, hey, just him showing up alive, just him surviving. Joe Wilson's calling him a liar. The governor of Arizona at the time, who's pointing her finger in his face on the tarmac. Reporters who disrespected him. I mean, it was extraordinary. All of the racist police who sent emails about him in Ferguson and elsewhere. So there was a sense that as long as this man can survive, given all the stuff he's up against, we'll be satisfied.
Mm. You talked about race. On the one hand, race is obviously such an integral part of our country, our history. Mm. And at the same time, there actually is no such thing as race, at least biologically
Absolutely.
Speaking. But it's how we see each other
perhaps
misperceive each other as well.
That's right. It's a great point. And that jarring paradox, the incongruity of, on the one hand, no such thing as race. You know, anthropologists tell us that, you know, even in a heterosexual paradigm, the ability to, you know, mate with another person means you in the same race. So that means all of us on Earth are. On the other hand, we know that even though it's not real, it's still true, that it has impact, empirical effect, power to reinforce value or to undercut meaning and value in your life. And so these artificial things that we create still have a meaning. This building is socially constructed like race, and if it falls on you, it'll hurt you. Mm. So the reality is that, yes, even though it's an artificial construction, it still has a tremendous impact on our lives. And the degree to which I'm asking white brothers and sisters, give up your whiteness and access your humanity. That's what we want to have. Whiteness is an investment. Whiteness is a political projection. It is not an essential characteristic of the human organism at birth. And if we can surrender what that might mean, we could challenge ourselves to become more fully human.
That was my 2017 conversation with Georgetown University professor and author Michael Eric Dyson about his book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. And that wraps up the Martin Luther King Day edition of Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Trinae Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.